Good day, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Gaming Guru Podcast. My name is Gareth Woods, and I'm joined by the always incredible Tim Lester. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you, sir.
Brilliant, brilliant. And today, we are actually following up on a conversation we started last week, which we tackled the idea that perhaps there is a culture at some studios of I suppose undermining or misrepresenting or even outright abusing some of the develop or some of their staff at some of the studios. And part of that conversation was a remark from a Ubisoft exec saying that games with girls don't sell. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that was generally the gist of it. And that was in reference to the idea that in some of the later Assassin's Creed games, there's been this choice between a male or female character, but that supposedly the latest Assassin's Creed, which is Odyssey, was supposed to be entirely female-led, but at the last second, kind of a male character was added because, according to this exec, games with girls don't sell. And so being the incredulous and, let's be honest, cynical and suspicious types that we are, we decided to do a little bit of research into that topic. And I think Tim managed to find quite a few nuggets of interesting kind of stats related to the question or the statement that games with girls don't sell. Tim, do you want to kick us off with some of that juicy knowledge there?
Defers, yeah, thanks, G. So I'm taking a look at Jeffrey Zatkins, who's the chief operating officer of EDA, which is essentially the market research firm for the games industry. So they looked at a sample of around 670 action games, shooters, and RPGs taken from the seventh generation console cycle. So that's, I guess, you know, looking back retrospectively, it's like the last generation Xbox 360, PS3, Nintendo Wii. in other words, everything in the last sort of 7 years. So out of those 670 games, less than 300 games in their sample had the option of a female lead. As for female-only leads, we're only looking at a whopping 24 games out of about 670. So in terms of pure sales numbers, in the first 3 months of availability, that's sort of where these companies will pull a lot of their stats to sort of see how well these market offerings have done. In those first 3 months of availability, games with only a female lead sold around 25% better than games with an option of a female hero. Games with exclusively male heroes sold around 75% better than games with only female heroes. Great. So by looking at these two trends, what becomes clear is that games that give you a choice of gender are, on average, reviewed slightly better than games with male-only heroes, but games that sell very well are most likely all led by male heroes. So if you're funding a large budget game, you're one of these investors and you see these numbers in your quarterly meetings, you see that you're losing out sales by adding capacity to choose a female hero, and you lose significant sales by releasing a game with only a female hero.
So let me paraphrase then. My understanding is going, tier one in terms of sales is male led. Tier two is male and female as an option. And tier three is female led. But you review higher, even though you don't sell higher, if you do have the option to choose gender.
Yeah. And then the next sort of big point that flows into this, and I think we can tackle these from both angles, has to do with marketing budgets. So Zatkins then found that female-led games received roughly 40% of the marketing budget as male-led games.
Okay.
So if we're breaking this down, you know, I'm wondering if this creates like a negative feedback loop where, you know, we've kind of seen this tiered structure, but at the same time, we're enforcing this tiered structure with the marketing budget and by, you know, tackling these projects with that mindset of them being, you're sitting in one of these three tiers.
I mean, the classic for me there is, I mean, we all know the example of Coca-Cola. It's the top selling soft drink in the world, and yet it has the highest marketing budget. And so it's dangerous to use marketing budgets as a KPI for success, because then you go, we have the most popular drink, which allows us the funds to have the biggest marketing budget, which allows us the highest top of mind so that people buy our drink, which gives us more money for more marketing. So using marketing budget is a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the same way as if you had zero budget, would you be as successful? Well, let's be honest, when brands are on top, it's a risk they're not really willing to take. I remember having a conversation with, at that stage, quite a high up distribution kind of manager for Activision. He was talking about how with Call of Duty, you know, he wondered what the sales would be like if one year they just didn't, you know, didn't do any marketing with it, because he felt like they'd reached a critical mass where there was this baked in audience for Call of Duty, where, I mean, basically they could just announce there will be a new Call of Duty, here's the launch date, and it would sell, maybe not as high, but it would sell 90% of the units it normally sold, but they would save so much marketing budget, because you're talking about these sort of games having upwards of $100 million in marketing spend, you know, for a release that happens every single year. And so is that slight loss in sales covered by the saving that you have in not having to market it? So I hear what you're saying there in terms of, you know, these female games are perhaps not doing as well because they're not given the support they need to even compete with the male-led games.
Which then sort of reinforces that cycle and that understanding, you know, that female-led games don't sell, so therefore we give them less marketing budget because they're falling down into like that third tier of, you know, what we're looking for with our sales projections. So with this in mind, and also bear in mind that we're, you know, this is specifically a sample of just, you know, 670 games of the last generation, I think that the market offerings have changed and are in sort of in a state of change at the moment. And I think that developers are more willing to take risks now. But if we take a step back and, you know, and put ourselves in the mindset of like these numbers here, if you're an executive, you know, sitting in one of these meetings, listening to pitches, and you have this in your mind, why would you then go and make a female-led game? Like, what are the drivers that give those games the green light?
Yeah, because I mean, it is difficult because as these companies are becoming more marketing and research-led and less creatively led, let's be honest, some studios obviously you feel definitely are led creatively, with others are led by market data and sales information, you know, that inform those decisions.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, the bigger, and arguably because they're bigger, most successful companies tend to have massive marketing divisions that are informing decisions like character development. I think off the top of my head, the only reasons you would then invest in a female-led character, you know, because it does fight against the trend from a sales point of view, is that you believe in representation. So you believe that the more different people are represented in games, the bigger the growth, you know, potentially for the category, but for your studio. So whether that's, you know, if we take the traditional representation as being white, cisgendered male, you're going to start seeing more games that are leading into players of color. You're going to see different genders and different sexualities. But knowing full well that you are fighting against what is A, historically the norm, but B, potentially the current user base. And so the risk is, how do you introduce new players, but without alienating your current players? So it's the one. I think potentially, and this is a more creative-led space, is going, you have the characters, whether they're female or not, based on what the story is that needs to be told. So if I take potentially one of the most recent outcries in terms of female-led games, Last of Us 2, you know, whether, if the decision is made that a certain lead male character dies, the character you will then play is going to be Ellie, let's be honest.
Yeah.
If suddenly they'd like woven in Tommy or some other random, you know, male character, just so that there is a male character to continue the story, it would have felt, ironically, what a lot of male players are complaining about, this kind of forced gender agenda, for lack of a better term, where you're going, this doesn't fit the story, but we are going to jam in the character that the market data says we need. You know, it's going, the next character should be Ellie, but we're going to bring in Tim, you know, no, you know, the names are coincidental, but we're going to bring in Tim, this new playable character that you've never heard of, because the market data says we have to have a white male because that's where the numbers are. So I think, I mean, maybe you can think of another reason why, but those for me are the main reasons why a studio would step out of the traditionally safe space of, you know, cis white male and into other spaces. Is representation is important to them and to the growth of gaming, or that they believe that the stories that need to be told need the right characters, and sometimes those characters are not going to be male.
Yeah, and I think something that came up for me, like while you were going over those points, was, you know, this whole idea that female-led, you know, games don't sell is in itself, you know, a product of kind of a big corporate game development, because, you know, going back, you know, going way back, female characters are always a big part of RPGs. You know, like looking at D1, even Dungeons and Dragons, you know, people have always been, you know, when it comes to role playing, like if the option to be female is there, they'll, most of the time they'll choose it. Like, you know, the rogue from Diablo 1 is synonymous with, you know, it's a female character. The Amazon from D2 is a female character. You know, if you want to make an Amazon, it's going to be female.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way that those character classes work. And no one thought twice about it. You'd be thinking about what build you're making, not, you know, about the gender.
So, and to be honest, it's kind of weird to have a male Amazon, just given the the connotations of the lore of Amazon.
The whole Amazon vibe. So then when I think about representation in video games, looking at like last and current gen, I think that has to be framed in under the umbrella of transformation. So we're looking at like transformation in boardroom decision making on game development. And then what is driving that transformation? Is it coming from the top or is it coming from the bottom? Is it coming from the players themselves? Are the players making themselves more vocal? Or is it coming from like external pressures from society, from the PR media cycle, or from the company's own employee base that says, we need our games to reflect our values more?
Yeah, fair enough. And I think what's interesting there is females have been in games. Like, usually, let's begin with the damsel in distress. I think Princess Peach is probably, you know, the one that comes to mind the most, as she must have Stockholm syndrome at this stage. She's been kidnapped so often. It's pretty much the premise of 95% of the Mario games. But like, she's then become a playable character and, you know, a little bit more independent and all that. But like, girls or females have been in games. It's just what role they've had to play. So very seldom have been the protagonist. In fact, you know, straight off the bat, I'm thinking of an example when a female protagonist was in an early kind of game, was the Metroid series. And that was more of a, like a surprise ending, going like, ha, let us toy with your ideals of manly man kind of ideas by having the female reveal the hero reveal herself to be a female at the end. Haha, gender normative. Like, what a twist, you know. And it really, if anything, kind of goes, it's an indictment to gamers at the time, going, you just assumed that this person in the super like Iron Man-esque costume must be male, like, haha, we tricked you. And then there are no other real strong female characters, you know, archetypes, D&D archetypes and the likes aside, until maybe Tomb Raider. But then even then, I think we chatted about this off air a little bit, the role that Lara had to play still felt like it was in service to a male gamer.
Yeah, so this is a, I want to chat about Tomb Raider in a bit more detail here, because I've just jumped into Shadow after playing the last two Tomb Raider games, you know, over the last few years, really enjoying them. And when I find myself coming back to Tomb Raider, because it always seems to be topical when talking about, you know, gender and representation in gaming.
Yeah.
And people point to Tomb Raider and Lara Croft as, you know, one of the biggest, you know, shining lights and beacons, which disproves the theory, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, when I look back at my experience of playing the first three Tomb Raider games, or was it Eidos Software?
Yeah,
was somewhere around there. Yeah. You know, those polygons, it was always, she was always sexualized. It was always, you know, in service of the male gaze. She always looked as though she was surgically enhanced, coming, you know, she'd just come back off the off the surgeon's table, you know, with you know, full collagen and all the bits popping out and stuff. And you always had that friend who had like the naked mod to make her, you know, to make her naked running around Venice or whatever. And so for me, you know, and then looking at the popular like images of Lara Croft, you know, these as a pinup model, you know, if you just do a quick Google search, a lot of those images that pop up of her, you know, in like bikinis or in like a slinky, like velvet, like one piece or something. And then taking that a step further and Hollywood casting Angelina Jolie, who at the time was like FHM sexiest woman of the year 2001 or some shit.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, getting into that role and further being, you know, a point of ogle, right, in of the male gaze, like in that role, that sort of like cemented that for me, like with Lara Croft. And you can see the shift from this old image of Lara kind of through the years towards kind of the Square Enix reboot and then the new form with Alicia Vikander as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I mean the reboots that happened with you know, the last three Tomb Raider games have kind of shown a maturation of that character. And I think it's like, you know, it feels like it's a theme in gaming in general that look at how out of place a character like Duke Nukem became.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of like 80s Arnie-esque, and I'm not even, I think that's an indictment to Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, in the past, because now Arnold is a, you know, a far more man of the world in terms of his pro-vegan stances and his pro-like equality and all sorts of like socialist reform type stances. Whereas like if Arnold Schwarzenegger of his characters of the 1980s ran for office, it would be a very different you know, kind of administration he'd be running in California. And so that's part of like almost this growth that characters have had. We look at Batman from, you know, the 70s and 80s being this campy, like weird sort of character, and so to his villains, to now being a far more mature character, and we engage with those characters more. And it feels like gaming has done the same thing, where those female characters have had to mature to be flawed and human and like realistically endowed, and you know, because they're real people that gamers and both male and female identify with far more so than the pinup-esque 1980s sort of barbed wire, you know, kind of
like
characters.
Okay, so I'm having like a big brain moment right now. You know, thinking, so I'm stuck on Duke Nukem at the moment, because I think as like a counterpoint to this discussion, Duke Nukem is a good example of, so a big Hollywood trend in action films of the late 80s, well, I'd say like late 90s, like 80, like 90, like 95 to 99, you had these like mega macho masculine like action men kind of taking on big baddies, you know, and what's his face, Arnie was at the front of that with like Predator, for instance, and we had Sylvester Stallone in fucking Rambo. And I feel like a lot of the action games that we got during that time were influenced by that trend in Hollywood.
Oh, of course, highly mimicked that.
And then if we kind of stick with that trend of like AAA blockbuster video games sort of mirroring what we're taking out of Hollywood, and then we kind of fast forward to the 2000s where like raunch was quite big, particularly in like the male market between ages of like, you know, whatever to whatever, you know, all those raunch comedies like Scary Movie and American Pie and that kind of shit, where it was like, it was in the main, you know, over-sexualization was in the mainstream. It was a big part of like mainstream pop culture, in the music, in the movies, and so too in the video games. And then we look towards like kind of speeding that up and fast forwarding to like current gen, where I think we're experiencing sort of like a cultural and social like renaissance in that area. Okay. Where we're starting to interrogate our own understandings of like of the genders and how we relate to them in media. So yeah. in books, in shows, in movies, and I feel like video games are starting to catch up with that.
Okay. I agree, and I think catch up is the right word, because gamers have traditionally been and still are a majority male kind of demographic, whereas, let's be honest, moviegoers or, you know, book readers and that has been a far more kind of equal community in terms of like the gender splits. You know, so gaming's been fighting this idea of going, we want to be more inclusive and get more representation so that new gamers feel that, you know, there are other characters to see and play and stories to tell, but they have been fighting against a, you know, much more weighted or stacked deck, you know, in terms of like they're fighting males who are going, no, this is our thing. And as I say that, there's also this very protective, it's kind of like a hipster culture. We see it in gaming all the time, the gatekeeping of going, you guys, you mainstream people with your stupid movies and your music and all that, didn't understand us gamers. And now that gaming is cool, you want to come in and change it and make it mainstream. Well, screw that. We are going to protect the old guard. And so a lot of the feelings, I think, are of guys going, that's the irony of being, you were bullied and so you found identity in gaming, and now you're going to bully other people who want to also find identity in gaming.
Because my games are sacred and 100%. They were a haven for me during my fat years.
I do get the fears people have of gender washing, where you go, imagine, for example, suddenly we found out Mario was actually transgendered. You'd be like, what? Seriously? Mario isn't even gendered. Like, he's not even really... His maleness is the fact that he has a mustache and a traditionally male name. There's nothing about him, except for maybe some really weird fan fiction, that makes him a masculine character or like a sex icon or anything. If you know what I mean? Like, it's just... He's just Mario. That's why I almost feel weird that franchises like Mario even get counted as male led, because it's almost like non-gendered. It's in the sense of going, it's like if you went, oh well, so is Sonic, or so is FIFA. FIFA, all the characters are male, but we're playing a soccer game, not a choose your own, you know, gender type like a role-playing game. And so it's almost like Tetris. Well, there's a clearly male blocks, because, you know, you've seen the shapes, how well some of them are endowed, you know, definitely male. And so it's almost like you feel some of the characters you need to remove out of this equation, because they, you know, when you're comparing marketing budgets and you're saying, you know, female budgets get 40%, are we counting Mario, for example, as a male-led budget? Because then no shit, Mario gets like massive budgets. I don't think it's because of his maleness. It's just, it's Mario. He's like the flag bearer of Nintendo.
That's actually a really good point. It'd be interesting to know, like, the games that they use to draw these stats from, because I mean, I don't want to cherry pick, because at the same time, like, those games are top sellers, you know, for a reason, and they will inform this data, right? But like, we're thinking like the Marios, the you know, the FIFAs, the CODs, those games that sell without even trying, you know, with those huge marketing budgets. Like, you asked the question earlier, like, you know, what would happen with COD if it didn't have a marketing budget? Well, what happened was, like, I get a message, one of my friends saying like, yo, you seen the new COD? I'll be like, no. Oh wait, I should download it. It's like, okay, fine, I will. He's like, are you gonna play the new COD? Probably.
Of course. But I want to jump back to how there has been a shift in more female-led games. And I feel like the key to the success of the ones that have been successful, and there are a lot, is that it hasn't felt like the decision to make the main character female was committee led. It feels like it was what the story needed. And I mean, just absolute shoot from the hip here, the latest Resident Evil remakes. You know, you've got Jill Valentine is, or yeah, is it Jill?
Jill Valentine, you're right.
Yeah. She is one of the darlings and the favorites of the Resident Evil series because she's a rich, strong character. It's not a case of going, well, we need a female. She's just one of the strong characters. Half-Life Alyx, I mean, I looked at some of the stats. There was an 80% quarter one growth for Oculus Rift year on year.
Sure.
And Facebook owns that. And they were going, the major factor was an external one of the launch of Half-Life Alyx.
Yep.
It like grew the sale of Oculus Rift in that quarter.
Sure.
And I mean, any game that pushes a hardware agenda is always going to be up against it. You know, like
indeed,
if you have to buy a piece of hardware to play a game, it's always going to be a hard sell, let's be honest, compared to, or you can play this game where you have everything and you just got to install it. I mean, that's half the reason why consoles do so well is like once you own the console, you can play any game that has that console. It's not one of those like, oh, damn, I have to upgrade my PC just to be able to play this one game. But yeah, I mean, we spoke about Last of Us, Tomb Raider, Celeste, Uncharted Lost Legacy is a great example. And I know you're a big fan of it, of a franchise entirely led by one character, Nathan Drake, and then them deciding to go into a different direction. But it didn't feel like one of those things of, oh, we need to create a female character. They had this rich character and this rich story that needed to be told. And if they suddenly had to jam, you know, once again, here comes Tim, our, you know, ubiquitous male character that we can just put into any game because we need a new Nathan Drake. And so we've got Tim to do it. No, like they've got this other character that they feel has another story to tell.
Yeah. And I felt really organic as well. It didn't feel forced at all. It felt like a natural progression that I was playing as these characters now. And even when they ended up teaming up with one of the Drake brothers, that also felt natural. And although, what's his name again? Nathan's brother completely escapes me now. His character came across as a bit clowny, as though like his presence in the game was like, you know, ended up being like a butt of a couple of jokes.
Yeah,
like,
he's the
woman
foil
ripped
to
on him like a lot. Yeah, but it felt natural, and I didn't feel as though any of those pieces were out of place. I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't have that sort of knee-jerk reaction that a lot of other gamers have of protectionism over my Uncharted, you know.
By the way, his name was Samuel.
There we go. Yeah. Samuel. And
yeah,
I think
exactly, that didn't feel like it was this committee-led decision of going, okay, so we've got a white male who's, I mean, heteronormative. We've got to have a player of color female who is, you know, lesbian, which is what the character was in the end. But if it's written well, it feels like that's the character's real story, as opposed to this idea of going, let's just, it feels like with photos, when you take the negative of, you know, it was just like everything that this character of, let's just make it the negative of, and they are our new anti-hero.
I think a game that, you know, we come to it a couple of times, Last of Us Part 2, and I want to sort of, you know, pivot back to this game as a sort of a good and bad example of transformation and slash, you know, and or catch up within the games industry, because in a lot of ways it is catch up. It makes a lot of, I'd say it would make a lot of ground in terms of changing our ideas of you know, female characters within a video game, you know, different body types, for instance, and different representations. You know, Ellie's not the type of girl who likes pretty things. You know, she's happy to put on like Joel's murder coat and, you know, and her like all-stars and just go like fuck up the world.
100%. Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
and you can say the same
body types as well. I mean, Abby has sparked an entire, probably its own subreddit on, you know, gaming body types and realistic female proportions and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I think as much as those like design decisions make sense, I still feel as though the execution on it was poor. Why? Because, I mean, we can largely say that Ellie's, well, I would say that Ellie's playthrough makes her feel largely unlikable. And that's like just her. Because, purely because of the decisions that we made. And my girlfriend likes to watch me play video games. She didn't like watching me play Last of Us 2. She kept saying, Ellie's an asshole, and walking out. And she's like, I fucking hate that game. Don't talk to me about that game anymore. Ellie's a dick. Like, that's all she was saying to me, right? And sure, I feel as though like she had more characterization and more personality in the first game, where she was like this, you know, snappy, wise talker with a sharp mouth, you know, who always was keeping the adults on their toes around her with her comebacks and always knowing too much for her own good, you know. And that was like lost in this game. And it was probably because of the journey that the character was on, and there was a bit of whiplash, like with, you know, kind of getting the player into that mindset of like where she's currently at emotionally, you know. But at the same time, I don't think it's doing much for the growth of her personality. And that's just Ellie. When it comes to, let's say, Abby, for instance, on the other side of the coin, there's a detail in the game that I missed, that I only picked up on when I was going through like an analysis of it at a later stage. There's a detail in the game. At some point you find out that Abby has been like gymming like every day for the past 2 years in order to sharpen her body into a weapon to, you know, destroy Joel Miller. It's like, so it's part of her obsession, the fact that she has these massive guns. It's the same as, you know, it's contrast to Ellie's obsession with revenge. Like, she dedicated 2 years of her life to like honing her body into a killing machine to like to take on this man, like with this one goal in mind. So, and I never knew that. I was like, oh, she's just jacked. I guess they got nothing else to do in the fucking zombie apocalypse but fucking pump weight.
Eat protein, you know?
Except eat protein and pump weight. You know, like one of the first scenes where she's missioning around the WLF base, you walk past the gym and you're like, okay, so she must spend a lot of time there. I had no idea that it was actually like a core part of her character development. And I think once I put it into, that was put into perspective for me, like I understood it a bit better.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't think, you know, on the topic of female body types, you know, it's been a discussion for a while. I mean, outside of gaming, it's been this idea that you need to show different types of people. I mean, we were both kids who grew up with like the He-Mans and G.I. Joes and all that. And it's nice to see, you know, dad bods. And, you know, maybe I'm, you know, it's nice that I have the option, but I might still play with the dude who looks jacked and ripped and everything I will never be. But I think a game that really took that to heart in terms of its body type representation has been Overwatch. You know, you've got big characters, skinny characters, they're from all different, you know, parts of the world, and you've got, you know, big girls and, you know, thick girls and thin girls and tall and whatever. But what's weird is there's this measure of authenticity. I feel like while Overwatch did that well from a overall execution thing, it never felt like the agenda was anything but a checkbox, you know, in terms of going. And I think a lot of people called them out on that. A lot of people called out Overwatch and Blizzard as going, cool, thanks for having an Indian character and all the likes, but it just feels like you basically did, you know, what's that? It's a small world ride. In terms of, you know, you rode past and go, okay, cool, we need people from the Netherlands, we need people from India, we need people from Africa. And you just kind of tick boxed, you know, every single, you know, race and demographic that you could. And then afterwards created backstories like, oh, okay, well, Tracer is lesbian. And, you know, I mean, talk about representation. You've even got a monkey because, you know, primate humans are all important too. You know, everybody's got to be represented. And so I think it's this weird space where, as much as representation is an agenda, it's hard to mask whether you're using it as a means to an end or whether it is actually an important part of your agenda.
Of your core values. Yeah, 100%. No, that's a really good point. But I think this is just kind of the natural, I think this is like a natural byproduct of transformation. Yeah. Because transformation is going to come from different angles, whether it's from top down, from management, because they're looking at the trends and seeing like, look, if we don't adapt, we're going to get left behind. or if it's coming from the ground up from your employees who say, we don't like the fact that the games that we are helping to produce are misrepresenting our values as millennials. Yeah. So we want to, you know, walk and go work for a company like Naughty Dog, for instance, you know. In either of those cases, you're going to have those driving factors moving change are going to come up against, you know, these types of arguments that you and I have been raising. You know, is it corporate feminism? Is it like diversity by committee? And in a lot of cases, it will be, just because of like these conversations being in flux at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, we got to go through this transformation to get to a point where it's normalized. And we were chatting about Last of Us Part 2. You mentioned all the debates going on around Abby's body type. You know, would we see those same type of debates, you know, happening on Reddit if a new Duke Nukem game came out and Duke was like kind of chubby,
dead he had bod.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
Like thin arms, like that. He hadn't been to the gym in like the last decade, and you know, he can't fucking climb over walls properly, and
yeah, exactly.
You know, the BFG is like a bit too big for him to hold. Like, you know, like, were we having those same discussions, or do we hold female protagonists to a totally different standard and we feel like we need to, like, you know, nitpick every tiny little detail because it's, you know, it's putting a new product in front of us?
Yeah, I mean, I can't even pretend to answer that question. It does open up, it does create more questions than it gives answers. Yeah. I think where we can leave things off, potentially leaving our own opinion, is that where we stand on representation as being important or not. I think, you're welcome to disagree with me, but I think, knowing you, we both agree that representation is important if only just for being able to tell stories that would feel contrived if told from the traditional white male perspective. So there are, just like in movies and in music and in books, now gaming has an opportunity to tell stories it's never been able to tell realistically, because, you know, it's always been from the angle of a very specific group of players. So I think that's important. And we've seen time and time again, I mean, how often do country sports teams talk about how important it is and how aspirational it is to be able to see yourself represented in your national sports team? If you are a young black female, to see the best tennis player in the world being a black female is hugely inspirational to your ability to go, I could do that, I want to get into tennis. And so what Serena and Venus Williams have done for tennis in that demographic is unfathomable how big their influence is. And so it's the same in gaming. I mean, you talk about self-fulfilling prophecies with the budgets. I'm going, why is it that the majority of game developers are white males? Because the majority of games were developed for white males when they were growing up. And so they've got plenty of heroes to pick from and plenty of experiences that they identify with. And so if you want diversity in the development space, it's almost like a chicken and egg thing, where are you going to get those games out without representation in your studios? But are you going to get representation in your studios if you don't have the games that are the heroes to those people?
So
it's a super tough one to answer.
So yeah, from my side, I guess my closing argument would be that we are finding ourselves currently in a period of transformation, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a long time, also because of the delay and the lag on video game development. And this might be a little side note, but something that my girlfriend brought up when we were like chatting about this kind of story of The Last of Us Part 2, she said, you know, this type of story with flashbacks and stuff would have been really hot in like 2014. And I'm thinking that was probably when like this thing was storyboarded.
Yeah, you know? That's the unfortunate part of games. The development cycle is so long that, you know, they're almost lucky in the sense that the message of a zombie apocalypse and that is so relevant because of Corona, you know, being when they landed. So a lot of people are like, wow, this is like feels, and a lot of the story really resonates. But, you know, like you said, some of the devices like flashbacks, it's not really how things are done now. You know, what they should have had was like a diary room entry, you know, like how Modern Family would do it, or where someone would speak to camera about, you know, what I was thinking here was.
So I guess what I want to kind of, the point I want to drive home is that these things do take time, particularly with video game development. And it's hard to future-proof yourself then, right? Like in order to, you have to be able to see where the trends are going and build that into your game, knowing that in 6-7 years time, that'll be relevant, right? So
I mean, you
it's going to take time.
You wonder if that's part of another reason why games as a service are successful as well, because your ability to pivot on trends in games like Fortnite,
way more agile.
Apex, all that sort of stuff. You're going, Travis Scott is huge. Let's do an event with Travis Scott. I mean, I can't imagine what the lead times were, but they can't on doing that Travis Scott event, but I can't imagine they're anywhere close to producing a AAA game.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, that's something that we can, you know, put down for another podcast. I think what I want to sort of to close off on here is that these things do take time. It's not going to happen overnight. And I just want to see more experimentation from developers and more risk taking.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of expanding their thinking of how games are tiered and these returns and the way they allocate marketing budget, more experimentation, throwing more things at the wall, because that way we get to normalize these things more. You know, it's easy to make like 3,000 or 4,000 Reddit threads about Abby and Ellie on The Last of Us 2 if the only like game we're playing with, like, you know, these, you know, different ideas of female-led characters is The Last of Us Part 2. But if we had 100 like 100 games like, you know, like that, you know, it wouldn't be such a hot topic. You know, it would be something more normalized. It would be something that we can like put on the same level as, or at least discuss in very similar terms to, it's like the talking point shouldn't be that the main characters are female. Like that should almost come like last.
And that's the irony, I guess, with Last of Us 2 is all the conversation that is negative has been around the characters and the story. No one has discredited in any way the gameplay. And it is, at the end of the day, a game. It is a phenomenal game. Its hiccups are in storytelling, pacing, and potentially, you know, its characterization. No one is saying anything bad about the game. And so I'd almost want to, you know, if I can leave with one point, is if the success of your game, either financially or, you know, in terms of reviews, is the coin flip on what the gender of your characters, there's probably something bigger wrong with your game. So if people were using Abby and Ellie and the story and all that as a springboard to then attack all the bugs and the, you know, the crappy gameplay, then you'd say, okay, cool, it's, you know, it's all part of a absolute train wreck of a game. But, you know, the game is solid. The game is really, really good. It's a great example of the kind of survival, you know, horror-esque third-person shooter. Like,
good video game.
Yeah, good games. And that's what we like talking about. If you've got any opinions that you'd like to share with us, please do feel free to message us on Twitter at @guru_podcast. Otherwise, Tim is at Tim and a Fish, and I am at the Gareth Woods. As always, it's been great hanging out with you, Tim, chatting about games. And for those of you who have listened, I hope you enjoyed it. And we will see you all again next week.
Adios.